This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you in the saddle with me for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 201, and of course streaming live or podcast on our HRRN website, which is horseracingradio.net. You know, since the very first Trainer Talk show with Ron Ellis was launched on HRN back in 2012, I've had the chance to bring you the stories of Hall of Fame trainers and trainers who are just getting started with their training careers, even assistant trainers with aspirations of someday making a name for themselves. And I can tell you, I have enjoyed every minute of diving into their stories. It's what I truly love to do. And what you learn when you start talking with people about their backgrounds and their upbringings is that Bill Mott wasn't always the Hall of Famer that we know today. There was a time when his horses weren't good enough to get stalls at B-level racetracks. Todd Pletcher, who appears to always be firing on all cylinders and have it all together, occasionally needs to pull up the replay of Uncle Mo winning the Breeders' Cup Juvenile to give him a bit of a pick-me-up. Those are the types of backstories that fascinate me, and I know so many of you have enjoyed them because you've told me, and you've made Trainer Talk one of the most popular shows on the network each week. But the one thing that I truly regret is not being able to spend more time with trainers who are based overseas. The stories of those trainers need to be told, and because cultures are so much different from country to country, the stories of their upbringings can be incredibly different than those that we hear from trainers here in the United States. And that's pretty cool. Today, I have the chance to welcome a trainer who has been based at Newmarket for several years before making the decision to relocate and move his operation to the United States back in November. On Sunday, he reached his first milestone here in the U.S. when he saddled his first North American winner in his ninth attempt. Al Nassim, a British bred, crossed the finish line first in an allowance race at Churchill Downs, and what a moment it was for trainer Ed Vaughn, who is my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Ed, welcome to the program, and congratulations.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be on.
Yeah, really excited to hear your story. And, you know, that moment at Churchill, I know you've won bigger races in Europe, and we're going to talk about those big wins, and I know you've been around horses that have been crowned champions. We'll talk about those too. But that moment at Churchill last Sunday had to be one that was pretty special for you.
Yeah, of course it was. And you know, to do it in your first winner here, it was a big move for us, obviously. And your first winner here, and to have it at such a prestigious track as Churchill Downs made it even more special.
One thing that I read in one of the press releases that was sent out afterwards was that you had mentioned that Al Nassim had been training well, but she had to get used to learning how horses run here in the United States, being a little bit quicker from the gates. What does that mean? What's different here?
I suppose, do you know what, Mike? When we train our horses at home, like we train them just to jump out the gate and more or less to flop out, because the races aren't really run from the gate at home. You just get them to relax. They go a little bit slower, and then they finish faster. So your horse has got to relax, breathe, not do too much. Whereas here, you'll find the races are pretty much run nearly 12-second furlongs all the way. So it's no build-up like a 13, 14-second maybe, and then finish well, sprint home. It's you know, they've got to learn to jump and run true pace all the way.
the other thing that was pretty cool is that Al Nassim was number one in that race. So when you took your winner's circle pictures, you had the number one saddle cloth next to you. And I thought that was appropriate considering it's your first North American win.
I won't be taking the credit for that one now, Mike. I didn't even realize it. It was a friend of mine who actually used to train in Newmarket, David Lanigan. And he was a neighbor of mine back at home. And I'm actually Amy and David. They've been very kind to me since I've been over here. They had moved over like about a year ago. And I'm godfather to their eldest child, Katie.
Oh, that's
and
so cool.
His idea. He said, why don't you all that up? It's one, sure. I wouldn't even have thought of it, to be honest with you.
That's so cool. And you
I'm
gave
not
a leg
any
up
of the
to
credit for that one.
Yeah, the man you gave a leg up to. You have history there. You're good friends with him. Tell me more about the rider Adam Biskiza.
Yeah, Adam is a very, he's what you call a very, he's just natural. He's naturally talented. Came from a well-known horse family in Newmarket. His dad works for Ed Dunlop, and his aunt is Julia Fielden, and she trains. She'd be a smaller trainer in Newmarket, and he grew up there basically, and was riding work. I don't know if you've ever seen the photo of him. I'll see if I can find it for you anyway. But there's a picture of when he was about 10 or 11, and he looked like a fully fledged jockey then. You know, he had a perfect seat on a horse, and I hope he's not listening to this, by the way. It'll inflate his opinion of himself even more.
What, you know, he burst onto the scene here in very short order once he moved his tack to the U.S. back, I think it was late 2017. He really did start to make a name for himself very quickly. What is it about Adam that just makes him really good aboard a horse?
I think a lot of the time, you know, I think he's got lovely balance. He was always going to do, as you see, a lot of our European jockeys, they're quite tall, and because of that, a lot of them can be a little bit bouncy on the saddle, and they just hate that over here. Whereas his physique is very good. He rides with a good length of rein, and he's happy to. You know who's another one actually is Holly Doyle. I don't know if you know about Holly Doyle. She's
sure.
a jockey sensation now at home, and she rides a similar style.
Was that important to you when you came here, Ed, to be able to? I know you had the relationship with Adam from back in Europe, but was it important to find riders that would fit your horses and the way that they were going to have to be ridden here in the States?
Yes. We ride them differently. I still train them a little bit the same, you know, in their works. I wouldn't be, you know, they kind of warm into their works rather than going straight from, we'll say, the four pole and whatever, especially for those turf horses. But it's good to have an understanding of these horses where it's say, look, at home, Adam, this guy was a little bit slow out the gate, or he jumped maybe a little bit keen, and they kind of get, I suppose, they're familiar with the lingo a little bit as well, you know. But he knows what I'm like. But somebody told me that he had said that it was David Carl said that I was a terrible hard boss back in the day, but I don't believe that.
I find that hard to believe. We've only been talking for 10 minutes, and I can't see you being that type of a person, Ed. Ed Vaughn,
yeah.
My special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. So what led to the decision to pack up and move here to the United States and move your entire operation back in November?
Do you know what? I was probably at that stage that I thought, you know, if I don't make this move now, it won't happen. And I kind of had to do it. And I had everything pretty much in place. And then I had a very good filly in Europe. She's one of the best fillies in Europe, named Dame Malio. And she won a group two, grade two against the Colts at the July meeting at Newmarket, which is a very prestigious group two. And even that day, you know, I remember looking at it, and her purse money that day, she won 32,000 sterling, which would be probably $40,000, I guess, somewhere around that. And, and I remember even having to do some repair work to my yard, put in like a horse exerciser. There was we had to put a new tile floor, rubber tile floor on it. And it cost nearly the same as what her purse money was. And you know what I thought to myself? I'm just spinning my wheels here. This business model isn't very good at all.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that, because when you talk to many trainers here in the United States, they will tell you that the business model here can sometimes make it difficult to continue being a horse trainer. But you think it's different here in the States than what it is in the UK?
Yeah, I'm starting to really realize there's not a whole lot of money in it here either, I'm afraid. But anyway, we'll get there. But there isn't a whole lot of money to be made out of training horses. You know, your daily rate, pay my lads very well, riders and grooms and everything, because I want to get the best people around me and build a team from the ground up. So you're going to pay them well, but there isn't a lot in the day race either. But you know, if you can kind of build a team, nice horses, it'll be winning good purse money. You can make your money that way.
And it sounds like a long road to go before you can finally get to that point. But that's what makes it so rewarding, too. When you finally do reach that level and you're winning big races and you're starting to kind of figure out a way to make a living doing this, it's got to be extremely rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. What is it, that expression? Is it the tougher the climb, the better the view from the top? But this is my second mountain now. But look, we'll get there. But it's all about getting better quality. I'll never be a trainer who's going to train a large amount of horses. You know, I need to be there with the horses every day and making the decisions. And you know, it's the owners pay for my eyes and my supervision over those horses. So I've got to be there. So I'll never have, you know, strings everywhere. You know, there are lots of trainers do it incredibly well and more luck to them, but it's just, it wouldn't be for me.
Yeah, I've always wondered, and I've asked trainers such as Todd Pletcher and Steve Asmussen and trainers that have multiple strings all over the country and they have assistants, and they always tell me the key is to have a good assistant in those different locations if you're going to be successful. They'll be the first to admit that, but I've often wondered how somebody like yourself, Ed, that is a hands-on trainer and wants to see his horses every day and has to be the man that people are paying for that has to be there, is it more difficult doing it that way to get to the top of the mountain because you don't have the numbers?
It is. It depends, I suppose, on where you're looking at the mountain. You know, if you want to train 300 horses and you want to be champion trainer or whatever, and you're happy to do that and delegate, well, that's fine. But you know, if you want to build, which I want to do, is a string of a barn full of nice horses, and just keep upgrading the quality. That's the perfect case scenario. However, you need numbers, and you need to find those horses, and the way to do it is through the numbers. But you know, it's not going to be a fast process. But if we can build, I want to build more in that direction of quality over quantity.
There could be people listening thinking, okay, wait a minute, you just didn't paint a very rosy picture of being a horse trainer and making a living at this game. If it's so difficult to do, Ed, why would anybody want to train horses for a living?
I suppose, to be honest, Mike, I'd say they're probably, like me, allergic to money and happiness.
That is a great line. But it's a love of the horse, ultimately.
Sorry?
It's a love of the horse, ultimately, isn't it?
It is. Listen, it is the love of the horse. And I see the young guys there, and I'll always, you know, always try to help them out. The guys who are starting in Newmarket and a new chap, you know, go into my yard to see, you know, they're enthusiastic. They want to train horses. We all do want to train horses. And it's something, you know, you feel like you want to do. You'll probably, as long as the next guy who thinks he's going to be, you know, the next Wayne Lucas or the next Henry Cecil, you know, that's what keeps the whole game rolling. But it's something, it's like I say, it's an itch you've got to scratch. And look, it is, I know it's, I'll tell you a quick story, actually. There was an old guy named Bill Whiteman, who was quite a good sprint trainer. And he was based out of Epsom, where the Derby is, the small training centre there. And Bill Whiteman, anyway, he trained some sprinters. But when he finished training horses, he wrote a book. And he called the book Months of Misery for Moments of Joy.
Appropriate.
And that that pretty much sums it up. But you know, those highs are just amazing, and it's like a drug of sorts, I suppose. You know, that winner evening on Sunday was just so rewarding, and you forget. You know, it's a tough business, but look, it's the one we've chosen to do.
Yeah, well, it was what Mark Twain that said that golf is a good walk spoiled, and I can attest to that, and I think so many people could, but there's still millions and millions of people that love the game of golf.
Sure, sure, and you're just hoping you'll hit that great shot, and that's the way it is. That's the way it is.
So why was Kentucky the place to come?
I suppose I knew some people. I'd kind of looked into different places. I had run horses, you know, I know you said the 9 runners I've had, but I've had runners in, we were unlucky enough to win the Woodbine Mile a few years back with a horse named Dancing Dance. It must be 8 or 9 years. And he got stopped in his run in Woodbine, and like all he had to do was get out, and he just couldn't get out, and he never came off the bridle. So I ran him back into Shadwell as well, and then I brought him back the following year to Shadwell, and that was 3 runners, and we had one in California. But I suppose Kentucky, I'd come to several times. I kind of like the environment here, and I looked into the track as well, and I think Keeneland's a fantastic track to train on. Really nice track, safe from what I've seen, and the horses, you know, that I'm used to training back in England, they're as sound and as healthy as what they were when I had them back at home, you know?
Yeah, plus you have the central location, so if you want to ship to other tracks, I think that makes it a bit easier too, doesn't it?
Sure, it's convenient, you know, for many tracks around here, and obviously the purses are very good at Keeneland and Churchill, and you know, there seems to be tracks to suit every horse. You've got Arlington up the road. I know it's a little bit further, but you know, for horses that like the poly track, we've got a few of those as well. So it's just a good location. It's very horse friendly, and the people around here are great.
Talking with trainer Ed Vaughn here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. If you're just joining us, Ed relocated from the UK, where he's had a ton of success, and we're going to get into that later in the program. He relocated from the UK back in November. He came to Kentucky. He is now based at Keeneland, and he recorded his first North American victory at Churchill Downs this past Sunday, and it was a tremendous moment for him and for his team. Ed, when you came here in November, did you bring a string of horses that you had in Europe? Did you bring them here with you, or did you just kind of start from scratch when you got here?
No, we brought, Mike, we brought four horses with us. All bar one, bar inhalation, were maidens. So we brought those. And I brought the ones that I thought would suit over here. And then Al Nassim, she was bought later on at the December sales at Tattersall's in Newmarket. But I brought four, then she arrived, that's 5, and the rest then we've picked up. We've got a dozen now, so the rest we've picked up, and we've got a couple of more to come in as well. But that's really it.
What's been the biggest challenge, and maybe even one that you didn't expect when you came here and you brought the string here?
Yeah, you know what, there's several different things. I mean, you move around a bit here, which I'm aware of. You move to where the racing is on. Probably, you know what, staffing is difficult, unfortunate at the minute, but you can see, you know, it's just like at home. You find less and less people want to work outdoors for some reason, and everyone kind of wants the job on the computer or the iPhone or iPad or whatever. And it seems less people want to work with horses. But you know, it's the different challenges. I mean, what I found quite strange is, you know, how you've got a license everywhere. You've got a license in when you have a runner at Indiana. You have to license when you're running at Chicago. You need another license there. You know, which I find extraordinary.
Yeah, that's different than in the UK, right?
Yeah, sure. You have one license. That's it. Even when you run in France or in Ireland, that license works for you internationally. But here it's, you know, the, I remember the runner in Indiana, and I was aware of it. She said, oh, have you licensed on yet? And I was like, well, I've got to get on that process and do that. Whereas it's more centralized, but you realize America is such a vast country.
Yeah, but one license across the board would make things so much easier. And it's something I've preached many, many times on this particular show and other shows.
One set of rules, Mike, all together, you know, be it medication or whatever. I think it's, you know, the time is right to do that. Now, I don't have the skill set or the knowledge in how to achieve that, but it would do, I think it would be much better for kind of centralizing it.
Yeah, how tricky has that been, trying to navigate those waters, Ed, when you do run a horse at different tracks? And you mentioned running in Canada. That's a whole different set of rules there. Is it difficult for a trainer to keep all of the different medication restrictions and protocols straight when they ship around the country?
Yes, it is, I'm sure. And I think it becomes difficult, you know, when you're moving horses from, you know, maybe you've got another string in some other place, or you've got a barn somewhere else, and you might end up putting a late entry in for something and maybe forgetting that it's a withdrawal on some medication there. But, you know, overall, I haven't the experience of it because we've only run it at Churchill and Keeneland. But I am very mindful of it, yeah.
Yeah, you'll learn before too long once you start shipping all over the country, and I know that day is coming once the string continues to grow here in the United States. Ed Vaughn is my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Ed, there are people that when they make a move such as the one that you made, relocating, coming all the way across the ocean to a brand new country, and they will say, you know what, this is it for me. Burn all bridges. I have no choice but to succeed. I don't have a fallback plan. Is there a fallback plan for Ed Vaughn if things wouldn't go according to plan over the next, year or so?
I don't know. I think people who have it in the back of their minds they're going to fail have fallback plans. I don't see it that way. You know, we'll be giving it our best go, and I think, you know, I think that we're going to make it work here, yeah.
If you were to sum up your training philosophy and describe to prospective new owners, hey, this is my approach, this is my mindset when it comes to training horses, how would you do it, Ed?
I don't know, really. I think it's all about observation to me, training horses. I don't have a schedule as such. I'll just see how they are within themselves and adjust my routine accordingly. I mean, we had one horse there, and I was probably just doing a little bit too much for him, and he's one of those horses that can't take. And it happened to me back in England as well, this same horse. And I remember, and he was saying, give me all the signs, he needs more work, and he's doing it easily. And then you just cross that threshold, and then it flattens him, and you've got to freshen him up then for a week and whatnot. And I was only saying it to the exercise writer there this morning, same thing, but it's all about getting to know them. And it's all about the overall well-being, that they're eating well, that they've got good energy levels and good bright eye, and they're just well in themselves. That's all you can do, you know. You're trying to speak for the horses and letting them express themselves to see how well they are in themselves.
Yeah, the other thing I've heard quite often from trainers on this show is that every horse is an individual. You can't pigeonhole one approach that's going to work for every single horse because they're all a bit different mentally, physically, whatever it might be.
Oh, totally, totally. And I think to get the best out of them, you have to think like that. And, you know, I know when you get certain numbers, you try to have some kind of a basic routine, but I think you've got to work the basic routine and then adjust little things at the other side of it, you know, whether you go a little bit slower or maybe give more trot days or whatever, you know, and you just got to adjust it as you see it.
You mentioned your exercise rider in the conversation that you had this morning. How important is that give and take and that relationship between a trainer and his exercise riders?
I think it's so important. I mean, I've seen people that you know, I don't know what it is, but they're nearly afraid to tell you if they think there's something. I encourage them to and try and give them the confidence that it's okay. You know, if you think this doesn't work, or you know, if he's maybe needs more of an equipment change. I mean, there's one filly there, Lark, who
rides out for me. She's a wonderful rider, and she's been riding this filly, and she throws her head about. And I've seen her for a while, and I'm just going, it's just the way she is. And we've tried everything. I said, well, give that a go. Give that a go. Cross nose bank, give that a go. And it's pretty much, the same came in today and said, yeah, it's pretty much, we've tried everything. And it's just the way she is. But it's important, you know, to have that. And I want her to have the confidence to you know, so it's okay to suggest things, and we'll try things. If they think it's going to be better, I'm not the one riding them. But if they feel that it's better for maybe putting on an extra piece of equipment on them, or maybe taking a little bit off, that's fine.
So there's a lot of experimentation that goes on from a trainer's perspective, trying to get it right.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, most of these finishes, but a lot of them are one in, they're one in pixels. And, you know, if you can just bring that little few pixels in a photo finish and it goes the right way, well, then it's worth it, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. How do you know, Ed, when a horse is, I've heard trainers talk about a horse sitting on a big race. How do you know when a horse is really ready to fire their best shot? What signs do they show you?
They'll just show well-being, a lot of energy. I like horses clearing themselves soon after work, which is something that seems to be lost now. It's like horses on clearing their nose. I find it a great aid to tell me on how well and how fit a horse is, and their overall well-being. And just how they are coming back as well from the track can tell you as much. And, you know, on the walk day as well, when they're out and they're having a pick of grass and they're just sharp and alert, and you know you've got them.
Do you recall a story of a horse that you've been around and you tinkered and you tried different equipment and it wasn't working, and then you thought you had it and maybe you didn't have it, and then all of a sudden you made the right decision. You put either blinkers on or you did something with the horse and the light bulb went on and the horse just got it. Do you remember a story like that that comes to mind?
We've had a few. Do you know what? Looking back on them, there's some horse I wish I had tried something now, tried different things. I remember old Dance and Dance, probably towards the end of his time. I wish I'd put on a pair of blinkers on him, because I just thought it might have just reinvigorated him, because he was always slow breaker in the stalls. If I had my turn again, I'd probably have done that. I've changed bits on, like, Marinissa, and I remember she was one out. She'd just do a little bit too much, and she'd carry her head quite high. So I made an adjustment on a bit with her, and, you know, straight away the rider said to me, this bit is fantastic, and it works well. And she ended up winning a listed. She only got beaten a pixel by Shala, who's champion 2-year-old in England, in Europe, actually. And this was as a 3-year-old. He ran once as a 3-year-old at Ascot, and she only just got beaten. It was just the draw got her. And she was fourth in the Haydock Park sprint as well. And probably that helped her a lot, I would say. It just got her breathing right and got her a little bit switched off.
So many little things that can make the difference between winning and losing. And
Vaughn
knows that.
And even Dame Hallio, now that you mention it. Yeah. She was a bit difficult, and she used to be difficult in the preliminaries. And she'd run at Newmarket, where we would just box them up on the trailer 1 hour before. And I remember Take Her Up, and I thought, I'd better paddock school. We wouldn't paddock school much because we don't train on the track, obviously. But I took her up for, because she had been a little bit headstrong on her second start, and took her up, and, gosh, she nearly tore the place asunder. She was very badly behaved, and I just put on a hood and cotton in her ears. And I remember the next day we ran her in a listed, which was a stake, the Aphrodite. Yeah, it was the Aphrodite, I think. And we just adjusted it. She was still quite badly behaved, and took her down. So we'll take the hood off her just before she goes into the stalls, and just took it off. And she went and won and broke the track record and holds it at Newmarket. And
wow.
It was just, I'm sure that if we hadn't done it that way, it might not have come off.
Wow, such a fine line between winning and losing, and Ed Vaughn knows that as well as anybody. We're going to talk more about the brilliant Dame Malio in the second half of the program. We'll also talk about some of the other top horses that Ed has been around in his career, and we'll talk about some of the people that have helped him along the way. Stay with me. Part two of Trainer Talk coming up next, right after this short commercial break. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Join us in June. Fasig Tipton's Santa Anita 2-Year-Olds in Training Sale returns in 2021 following a successful inaugural sale in 2019. This year's catalog features 2-Year-Olds by leading national and California-based sires such as Constitution, Curlin, Empire Maker, Grayson, Hard Spun, Into Mischief, Liam's Map, Malibu Moon, Medallia Doro, Munnings, Nyquist, Pioneer of the Nile, Square Eddie, and Smiling Tiger. The Fasig Tipton Santa Anita 2-Year-Olds in Training Sale will take place Wednesday, June 23rd at Santa Anita Park in Arcadia, California, with the Under Tax Show scheduled for Monday, June 21st. Where will you be?
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
A Lunac Communique on the right, Dame Mayo. They're followed by Old Persian. And then back in behind them, Desert Encounter, still getting closer, followed by Emberhar. Racing on now inside the final furlong and a half. And Communique in the center, the horse that loves Newmarket. But Desert Encounter is weaving through behind them. Dame Mayo is battling on the far side. Then a Lunac now beaten off. And Dame Mayo is staying on really gamely on the far side of Communique and forges on again. Emberhar running on too late. And Dame Mayo came clear to win the Princess of Wales' Stakes.
Just one of many shining moments in the career of trainer Ed Vaughn and Dame Mayo, who was so, so good. A little trip down memory lane for my special guest. Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you back with me. If you missed any portion of our conversation in the first half of the show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, simply head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to a podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure. They're there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. Ed, that moment right there had to be very special for you, and I wanted to find some way to welcome you back to the second half of the show, and all of a sudden you started talking about Dame Malio at the end of the first half, and it couldn't have been any more perfect.
Oh, no, that's good of you to say. I've got my timing right for once in my life, then.
She was, I know you told that great story at the end of the first half of the program before the commercial break, but she was a really, really special horse, wasn't she?
Yeah, very tough. Wouldn't have been probably the best of, actually, her sire, who was not a bad stallion at all, Champs-Élysées, who was the fantastic Judman family, and he had actually gone, his stats were quite good, but he had gone to become a National Hunt Stallion, which is Jump Stallion in Ireland, had since passed away. So she wasn't really one of the more fashionably bred ones, but Anthony Oppenheimer, who is, you know, he wouldn't have a big broodmare band, but he's got a fantastic, he's just got the best bloodlines, and he does a great job mating his fillies with sometimes unfashionable stallions, and you end up with a Dame Malio.
Yeah, boy, could she could run. That was a special moment right there. When you think back to how this whole journey began, Ed, what are some of the things that come to mind when you start thinking about, first of all, making the decision to get involved with horse racing, and then some of the people that helped you in the early stages?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. I even hate mentioning names, but there have been so many people along the way, you know, great supporters. When I took over at Alex Stewart's, I had some owners like Alan Pickering, who was with me, very small owner, unassuming, ended up getting a couple of more horses. He probably had three with me at the end. And we never had a cross word or raised, you know, he was just one of those. He was just a wonderful man to train for. He had a lot of challenges himself. He is a wonderful man. And he's been blind since he was, I think, 20.
and he has been extremely successful in doing pensions and so on for the government, and he excelled in his own in his own profession. And he just loves having racehorses and just going to see him run. And we could have actually gone to, you know, and probably won more races than we travelled, but he liked going to his local tracks and whatnot. So we try and accommodate him in that sense. But we, you know, Alan came with me, Mike Hawkes, there were, you know, several of those owners that came with me, and they were wonderful. So we owe them a lot. You know, they've supported me all the way through. So very fortunate in that front.
Occasionally we'll see trainers that develop relationships with their clients like that, and they become more than just a client, more than just somebody that you're training for. They become a friend, and they become part of the family. And those stories are really special, Ed, and they're the type of things that really help make the downtimes in the training profession. It helps you get through those a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's no matter what, you've hyped yourself, think you're going to win a race, and look, a lot of the times it just doesn't happen, or something has a bad day, or the ground goes too soft, or there's one thing or another. But, you know, when you train for people like that, Mr. Oppenheimer, he was the same way. You know, no matter if I rang him and told him, look, that two-year-old you sent me is absolutely useless. You know, you need to breed from her, just take her home. She's not a racehorse. And, you know, he'd always say, I'm really sorry, Ed. I must try and send you something better. And he'd send something else. Just a wonderful man. He could take the bad news with the good, and, you know, just wonderful to train for. And, you know, you make the right decisions when you train for people like that. You always want to do well. You want to do well for everybody, let's face it. But, you know, when you have somebody that understanding, you're probably not as afraid maybe to make a mistake. And you just do right and give the horses time if they need it. And, you know, it's great to be associated with owners like that.
Yeah, very well said. It's a great point. How did you first become interested in horse racing? Did you come from a racing family?
Yeah, very much so. I had quite a famous uncle who was a very good amateur jockey who won at Cheltenham. My granddad, he trained jump horses. But I remember actually at home, he had, there was a filly, what was her name, Golden Glen. And she won, this will tell you about horses back in the day, and she was this tiny filly who was, this is, I'm going to say, in 1940 something or other, and there was a picture of her at home, and she won two races in one day. Can you believe that?
Wow. Two in one day.
They wouldn't have traveled on vans in those days. They'd have gone behind maybe a horse and car and running these point to points which was like small meeting and jump meetings over banks and ditches. And you know, that was just a tough, they were just tough breed of horse, weren't they?
Yeah, two races in one day. I've heard of horses here in the States back in the day of winning, you know, two races in consecutive days, but never two in the same day.
Yeah. That happens in England as well, you know. That happens in England where we'd run horses. I know Sir Mark Prescott who does it very well, and he's had horses, I think, in like 2.5 week stretches, and they might have won five races.
Wow. Wow. Talk about a throwback type of horse, huh?
Yeah, they're tough, but you know, they say the breed was tougher then. I suppose they had to be, or you know, they were just, horses were, you know, they were work animals.
Do you think that's true? Do you think the breed was tougher years ago?
Well, you know what, Mike? I often chat to people, and Sir Mark Prescott was a wonderful man to chat to. You want to get him on this show now. You talk about interesting, you might as well just leave it for 5 hours, but you'd be as fascinated by after 4 hours, 59 is what you would at the start. Wonderful guy to talk to. And I said it to him, and he'd be the one guy that would disagree. He said, you know, the horses were changed, that, you know, they had the same type of problems as what horses have now. Yet you'll speak to, you know, different people. You say, like, John Gosden, and he's convinced that the horses have gotten softer. Because, you know, a lot of people now, horses are bred nearly for the sales ring. You know, you've got to breed the mare. Maybe not so much to what you think will suit a stallion, but you also, you know, the horse has got to make its money, and these nominations are expensive. They've got to make as much as they can at the sales, you know, as yearlings. And if you don't kind of tick all the boxes and have them buy, you know, it's kind of a throwback to Dame Malio. That mare was bred, Dame was bred to kind of an unfashionable stallion because the stallion would suit the mare, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it does make sense. I've always said that, and of course, not being a horse trainer, not being around horses on a daily basis, but I've always thought that maybe it was more the economics of the game and the sport changing as opposed to the horses and their durability changing. Would that be fair?
Yeah. You know what? I haven't got the answer. You'd have to have. So I'm sure people had the same problems back then. But yeah. I know people think it's more to do of late. It's probably got to do with medication. And these horses, obviously, they didn't breed as many mares back then. And I suppose the truer, sounder stallions came to the fore because, you know, without medication, I suppose that's another issue maybe for another day. I don't know, but... I think the true, really great horses came through for that reason. You know, they didn't bleed and, you know, they didn't have any medication. And I don't know. Everyone's got an opinion on it. And I don't have the answers either.
So coming from a family that was so tied to steeplechase racing, did you, Ed, initially spend time working with steeplechase horses or did you go right to the flat horses?
Yeah, it was nearly all steeplechase horses for a long time. It was we stood stallions at home. My uncle and my granddad at the other side of the family stood stallions, National Hunt stallions, Jump stallions. Had some quite nice stallions. We stood stallions at home when we were a kid. When I was a kid, you know, I grew up in a stud farm where we had some jump mares and also stood a couple of National Hunt stallions. One horse actually was quite a good horse over here. He ended up his second part of his career, I think, over here, was a horse named Alpha Batum, who was a Judmont horse.
Okay.
Him over here when he trained in California.
Gotcha. What eventually led you to make the move from steeplechase horses to working with the horses on the flats?
I went to the National Stud when I was 18, where, you know, we meet a lot of our friends and colleagues and people we do a lot of business with now. Went there together, like Brendan Walsh. Brendan was at the National Stud as well. You get to meet a lot of people, and through that you meet those connections. Then maybe somebody might say, oh, well, why don't you go to America? So I ended up going to Spring Hill Farm anyway after the National Stud in Virginia, near Middleburg.
Okay.
And worked for Ned Evans there, and he had a wonderful little, you know, really nice boutique, kind of a boutique stud where he had fantastic mares, and, you know, they bred likes of Quality Road, and Menstrella was on there, was a European champion, two-year-old. And then I went back to Ireland after that for a spell, and then I wanted to come more rounded, I suppose, in it. And I ended up going to Charlie Mann in Lambourne, who hadn't started very long. It was probably 2 years training, maybe three, 2 years probably. And he was looking for an assistant. He was expanding. So I was with him for a couple of years. And then I moved to Noel Chance, who was a very small trainer in Lambourne, but had, you know, with 15 horses, he had won the Cheltenham Gold Cup twice with two different horses within about 4 years. Mm-hmm. So a very talented trainer. So I was assistant to Noel for a bit. And then I wanted to move into the flat side of it. And so after 2 years at Noel, I went to Alex Stewart, who was in Newmarket, and he wanted an assistant. And he was being treated for cancer, and he hadn't had an assistant for years, and he wanted somebody there who could kind of take care of the show when he was, you know, a little bit poorly. So I was there for probably a year and a half, and then poor Alec, God rest him, he had this relapse. It looked like he was going to be fine, and he had a relapse, and it all, you know, for him, he passed away within
like 10 days. I remember seeing him one day and he was heading off and I never saw him again. You know, he said, I'll speak to you in a few days. And he went to a holiday home and then I didn't see him after that. So I was then left with a barn full of horses. I think we had about 70 horses then. And it was kind of a baptism of fire, if you like, I wasn't even aware of it. And you suddenly wake up one morning and you get a call to say, you know, the governor won't be back to the yard. So then the license was transferred into my name. And then we had a lot of sick horses at the time. We had an EHV outbreak. I think it was one of the few that's happened in England. And we had an EHV outbreak, and then we were shut down for a while. So then we had to wait for the horses to get healthy again. And it went on from there, and we had some success. And that's where it started.
Yeah, and that was 17 years ago. It was actually 2004 when Alec passed away. He was only 49 years old. Very sad story there. But as you mentioned, he was sick with cancer and battled that for a very, very long time. Were you thinking, Ed, that maybe at that point in 2004, maybe before too long, you would try to go out on your own? Or were you thinking, I'm going to be with Alec for as long as he wants me here?
Yeah, I was looking at, you know, there's always a time in your life when you're kind of thinking, you know, maybe one more season and see what's out there. And I thought about maybe going to Dubai. Dubai was very good at the time. And I thought about maybe going to Dubai. Dubai, there was opening up. There was a lot more racing there. And looking at Asia as well, it seemed made more sense to set up there. And I contemplated America as well at that time. And just the whole thing kind of snowball. You had a bit of success. And then the end of the year, obviously, a lot of those horses were owned by Shadwell and Sheikh Ahmed, at which they were going to go to other trainers at the end of the year. So then I was left with six horses. It's probably six. And they weren't very good ones, I'm afraid. And then I went up and trained out of Henry Cecil's yard up at Warren Place. Henry only had, you know, he was really down in numbers. And it seemed to be, you know, it seemed to be dwindling. I don't know if you know the whole story. You know, he really went down in numbers. And I think he only did the first or second year that I was there renting a barn from him. He had like 9 winners. And, you know, there wasn't even a winner of any account came out of there. And then, yeah. of course, Frankel arrived. I had just left at that time, but Frankel had arrived. And so then I had a brilliant 3 years up there. And on the third year, you know, it just snowballed with plenty of success with moderate horses. And they seemed to do well and thrive. It was a great place to train out of the Warren Place. And I needed a bigger premises. And Henry had a brilliant year that year as well. And he needed more stalls as well, if his old stalls back. And he was just wonderful. I mean, he ended up being such a good friend. I ended up getting another yard in town and so on.
Yeah, just an amazing story as to how this all came about and, you know, how things work in life. Sometimes you just step back and you know, things happen for a reason here you are 17 years later training here in the United States, you know, with your own string here. When you first decided in 2004 after Alec's passing that, okay, I'm going to continue on, I'll keep as many horses as I can, I'll start training on my own, were there other trainers that you would go to and more established trainers and pick their brain and say, hey, any advice you can give me here, anything you can tell me that might help me because of the situation that I'm in?
Well, I suppose I had a bit of Henry was probably the one.
Yeah.
Was the one person. Now everyone is fantastic, don't get me wrong, but Henry was just an extra special man. I know you've read these things and he was so popular with everybody, but Henry had a great way, not only with horses, but I think with people he was just as good. He was a very sensitive soul.
But I remember, like, David Lanigan at the time, he was his assistant, and I didn't have any barn to go to. When we say barn, or, I mean, we'd say stables at home and a yard. And I didn't have anywhere. There was nowhere suitable. It was becoming a nightmare. And, you know, you had owners saying, oh, well, where are you going to train out of? And the one thing you find that owners don't like, that kind of uncertainty. And Henry came jogging up to me on his hack one day, and he said, I hear you're struggling to find a suitable premises. And he said, I have got lots of stalls above at my yard, and you need to come up and see me. I will make room for you, and we'll make it work. And he was just incredible and such a help. You know, I worked horses with him, and I don't think I'd be here today talking about it if it wasn't for him.
What things did he do and teach you that you're still using when you train horses today, Ed?
Sorry?
What things did he teach you when you were with him that you're still using in your operation today as you train horses?
Do you know, Henry kept things incredibly simple, you know, in the way he trained. It was very much, you know, he had a pretty set routine in the way he did just a chore. But it was very simple when you watch how he trained his horse. He kept it all very, very simple and very relaxed. Still ran like clockwork, but he'd relaxed. He'd have a laugh with the guys riding out, and he made it fun for him. And he was always caring, you know, if they had any personal problems. But even the way he fed him, Mike, it was fed, you know, he just fed oats. That was all that was fed morning, noon and night. He fed oats, bit of bran, bit of plus vital, bit of salt and bit of oil. But it was so simple. Good Timothy hay, and he never went for any of these new mixed feeds or anything like this, and these things promising you this, that, and the other. And he kept it in his horses. You know, they were well trained. He trained them. You know, they had a good work ethic, and he gave them enough work, and he ran them, and they competed. And it was the one thing I admired about Henry. And you know, he did things pretty much the same way. And it's such a difficult thing to do when you're going through a tough period. You're thinking, can I change this? I need to change that. But, I mean, he had so much success doing it that way. He knew that the horses were the problem. It wasn't the way he was doing it or the way he was feeding them. So he had the confidence to keep everything right. And sure enough, the whole thing turned around. And then Lightship came along. She won the Oaks. And then Frankel came along. And then he was up to 140 horses. And he was the king again.
Visiting with trainer Ed Vaughn here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Ed, I'm going to mention a couple of names, and I'll let you tell me more about these horses, because I mentioned in the first half of the program that you've had the chance to be around some really good ones. And one of those you were able to be around in the early days anyway was Dubai Millennium, a horse that was a multiple grade one winner, won 9 of 10 lifetime starts, $4.4 million in earnings. You had the privilege to be around him early on. Tell me about that story.
Yeah, very early on. He came in from one of the studs, one of the sister studs at Kildangan at Darley. And he came in, and I remember Jimmy Lenehan was the pre-trainer at the time, and he used to bring him in, and he'd like me driving him in long reins and getting that early work into him. It's where we basically walk like a rider, but you're on the ground. Long reins we run through. I don't think they don't do it much over here, but it's very much a traditional way of breaking horses at home. And you put on the saddle and the saddle and a bridle, and you run long reins like lunge lines, and walk behind the horse. So you put a nice mouth on him without having a rider on board, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And you lunge him like that with both reins on and the whole thing. And he was quite a headstrong character. He came in, we started him. I remember we started him all over again. And he was just a big strapping colt, like most of those colts we had there. I mean, we had when you look back at it, like Al Mutawakil, Al Tibber. God, there were too many Faek. I mean, you could just name them on and on. And one was more beautiful than the next. You know, they weren't just great pedigrees. They had there were great physicals with it. I mean, there was anything under 500 kilos. They were just massive, massive horses. And he was a very headstrong colt, very natural. I can't say I did anything that helped him along in life because, you know, he's just a gifted athlete.
Ed, there are so many others I want to flip through with you, but we are down to the final 3 minutes or so in the program. This hour-long visit has flown by. Fiorenti is another one I wanted to ask you about, the winner of the 2013 Melbourne Cup, and unfortunately we don't have time there. You had horses in your care. We talked about Dame Malio and Group 3 winner Robin Hood's Bay. Didn't get to those horses either, but that's okay because I know we're going to have more big horses to talk about up the road. What does the future hold now? At least, what do you hope it holds for Ed Vaughan here in the United States?
Look, all you can do is hope that you do well with every horse that's sent to you. But, you know, it would be nice to find a really, you know, a proper Group 1 horse, Grade 1 horse in the next couple of years. And that's what we'll be striving to get. But like I said, I'm never going to be a big numbers trainer, but I just want to train more quality over quantity. And that's really it. What more can you expect? You can only hope for it. But, you know, you just got to hope that those nice horses come along. They're rare, but they do come along.
Yeah, they do. And you have to think with your experience and your background and your resume that those horses are in your future for sure. Ed, I always like to wrap it up, the final couple of minutes of the show, by asking trainers to let me know something about them we haven't talked about yet that people might be interested in, other hobbies, other interests, other things you like doing outside of horse racing. What might it be?
Fishing. I love fishing, and I haven't been able to do it because in Newmarket, you don't get much time off, and you know there weren't any rivers. It's a very flat area, and you don't have any nice chalk streams and rivers. And I'm looking forward to doing a little bit of that the odd evening when we can kind of get familiarised with the locality. So I'd like that. That's fly fishing, and I also do a bit of shooting in the winter. I used to do a lot of pheasant shooting when time permitted. I look forward to that as well. And working my dog. That's really it. I've got a wonderful Labrador who seems to be better known than I am. And he's a wonderful retrieving dog. So I enjoy taking him out and working him as well.
Oh, what a wonderful visit it's been. Ed Vaughan, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Ed, I hope you get a chance to get out and enjoy all of those things that Kentucky has to offer. And I hope you pick up those Grade 1 winners before too long. I have a feeling it won't be long before you're in the winner's circle with some of these big races. Really appreciate the visit this morning or this afternoon, and all the best going forward.
That's very kind, Mike. Thank you very much indeed.
All right, Ed Vaughan. If you missed any portion of the show, head to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure. For my producer, Lee Delapina, and for my special guest, Ed Vaughan, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.